Her name's not Rachel Lane.
What the hell is it?
Nate thought hard for a second, then fatigue hit him. He slumped a bit, still trying to remember her name. Maybe she never told him her last name.
I don't know,
he mumbled, his lips barely moving. Valdir pressed the phone harder.
Nate, talk to me. Did you find the right woman?
Oh, yes. Everything's okay down here, Josh. Relax.
What about the woman?
She's lovely.
Josh hesitated for a second, but he couldn't waste any time.
That's nice, Nate. Did she sign the papers?
I can't think of her name.
Did she sign the papers?
There was a long pause as Nate's chin dropped to his chest and he appeared to be napping. Valdir nudged his arm and tried to move his head with the phone.
I really liked her, Nate suddenly babbled. A lot.
You're stoned, aren't you, Nate? They've got you on painkillers, right?
Yep.
Look, Nate, call me when your head is clear, okay?
I don't have a phone.
Then use Valdir's. Please call me, Nate.
His head nodded and his eyes closed.
I asked her to marry me,
he said into the phone. Then his chin fell for the last time. Valdir took the phone and walked to a corner. He tried to describe Nate's condition.
Do I need to come down there?
Josh yelled for the third or fourth time.
That is not necessary. Please be patient.
I'm tired of you telling me to be patient.
I understand.
Get him well, Valdir.
He is fine.
No, he's not. Call me later.
Tip Durbin found Josh standing in the window of his office, staring at the cluster of buildings that composed his view. Tip closed the door, took a seat, and asked,
What did he say?
Josh kept staring out the window.
He said he found her, that she's lovely, and that he asked her to marry him.
There was no trace of humor in his voice. Tip found it humorous nonetheless. When it came to women, Nate culled little, especially between divorces.
How is he? Feeling no pain, pumped full of painkillers, semi-conscious. Valdir said the fever is gone and he looks much better.
So he's not going to die. It appears not. Durbin began chuckling.
That's our boy Nate. Never met a skirt he didn't like.
When Josh turned around, he looked quite amused.
It's beautiful, he said. Nate's bankrupt. She's only 42, probably hasn't seen a white man in years. Nate wouldn't care if she was ugly as sin. She happens to be the richest woman in the world. I'm not surprised, now that I think about it. I thought I was doing him a favor, sending him off on an adventure. It never occurred to me he would try to seduce a missionary.
You think he hit on her?
Who knows what they did in the jungle?
I doubt it, Tip added on second thought. We know Nate, but we don't know her. It takes two. Josh sat on the edge of his desk, still amused, grinning at the floor.
You're right. I'm not sure she would go for Nate. There's a lot of baggage.
Did she sign the papers?
We didn't get that far. I'm sure she did, or he wouldn't have left her.
When is he coming home?
As soon as he can travel.
Don't be so sure. For 11 billion, I might stick around for a while. Chapter 36. The doctor found his patient snoring in the shade of the courtyard, still sitting up in bed, mouth open, gauze removed, head fallen to one side. His friend from the river was napping on the ground nearby. He studied the IV bag and stopped the flow. He touched Nate's forehead and felt no fever.
Signor O'Reilly,
he said loudly as he tapped the patient's shoulder. Chevy jumped to his feet. The doctor did not speak English. He wanted Nate to return to his room, but when this was translated by Chevy, it was not well received. Nate pleaded with Chevy, and Chevy begged the doctor. Chevy had seen the other patients, the open sores, the seizures, and dying men just down the hall, and he promised the doctor he would sit right there in the shade with his friend until dark. The doctor relented. He really didn't care. Across the courtyard was a small, separate ward with thick black bars sunk in cement. Patients wandered out from time to time to gawk through the bars into the courtyard. They could not escape. A screamer appeared late in the morning and took offense at the presence of Nate and Chevy across the way. He had brown spotted skin and red patchy hair and looked as crazy as he was. He clasped two bars, stuck his face between them, and began yelling. His voice was shrill and echoed around the courtyard and down the halls.
"What's he saying?" Nate asked. The lunatic's yelling startled him and helped clear his head.
"I can't understand a word. He's insane. They have me in the same hospital with the crazy people?"
"Yes. Sorry, it's a small town."
The yelling intensified. A nurse from the safe side appeared and shouted for him to be quiet. He lashed back at her with language that made her run away. Then he refocused on Nate and Chevy. He squeezed the bars until his knuckles were white and began hopping as he screamed.
"Poor guy," Nate said.
The screaming turned to wailing, and after a few minutes of non-stop racket, a male nurse appeared behind the man and attempted to lead him away. He didn't want to go, and a short scuffle ensued. With witnesses, the nurse was firm but cautious. The man's hands, however, were glued around the bars and could not be removed. The wailing turned to shrieking as the nurse tugged from behind. Finally, the nurse gave up and disappeared. The screamer pulled down his pants and began peeing through the bars, laughing loudly as he aimed in the general direction of Nate and Chevy, who were out of range. While his hands were free, the nurse suddenly attacked from the rear, grabbing him in a full Nelson and dragging him away. Once he was out of sight, the yelling ceased immediately. When the daily drama was over and the courtyard was once again quiet, Nate said,
"Chevy, get me out of here."
"What do you mean?"
"Get me out of here. I feel fine. The fever is gone. My strength is returning. Let's go."
"We can't leave until the doctor releases you, and you have that," he added, pointing to the IV in Nate's left forearm.
"This is nothing," Nate said as he quickly slid the needle from his arm and yanked the IV free. "Find me some clothes, Chevy. I'm checking out."
"You don't know, dengue. My father had it."
"It's over. I can feel it."
"No, it's not. The fever will return, and it will be worse, much worse."
"I don't believe that." "Take me to a hotel, Chevy, please. I'll be fine there. I'll pay you to stay with me, and if the fever returns, you can feed me pills. Please, Chevy."
Chevy was standing at the foot of the bed. He glanced around as if someone might understand their English.
"I don't know," he said, wavering. It was not such a bad idea. "I'll pay you $200 to get me some clothes and take me to a hotel, and I'll pay you $50 a day to guard me until I'm okay."
"It's not about money, Nate. I'm your friend."
"And I'm your friend, Chevy. And friends help friends. I can't go back to that room. You saw those poor sick people in there. They're all rotting and dying and pissing all over themselves. It smells like human waste. The nurses don't care. The doctors don't check on you. The insane asylum is just over there. Please, Chevy, get me out of here. I'll pay you good money."
"Your money went down with the Santa Lora."
That stopped him cold. Nate had not even thought about the Santa Lora and his belongings, his clothes, money, passport, and briefcase with all the gadgets and papers Josh had sent. There had been few lucid moments since leaving Rachel, just a few clear intervals during which he had thought about living and dying, never about tangible things or assets.
"I can get plenty of money, Chevy. I'll wire it in from the States. Please help me."
Chevy knew that dengue was rarely fatal. Nate's bout with it appeared to be under control, though the fever would surely return. No one could blame him for wanting to escape the hospital.
"Okay," he said, glancing around again. No one was near them. "I'll return in a few minutes."
Nate closed his eyes and contemplated his lack of a passport. Andy had no cash, not a dime, no clothes, no toothbrush, no sat phone, cell phone, no calling cards, and matters weren't much better at home. From the ruins of his personal bankruptcy, he could expect to keep his leased car, his clothing and modest furniture, and the money put away in his IRA. Nothing else. The lease on his small condo in Georgetown had been surrendered during rehab. There was no place to go when he returned. No family to speak of. His two older kids in college were distant and unconcerned. The two middle schoolers from the second marriage had been taken far away by their mother. He hadn't seen them in 6 months, and had scarcely thought about them at Christmas. On his 40th birthday, Nate had won a $10 million verdict against a doctor who failed to diagnose cancer. It was the largest verdict of his career, and when the appeals were finished 2 years later, the firm collected over $4 million in fees. Nate's bonus that year had been $1.5 million. He was a millionaire for a few months until he bought the new house. There were furs and diamonds, cars and trips, some shaky investments. Then he started seeing a college girl who loved cocaine, and the wall cracked. He crashed hard and spent 2 months locked away. His second wife left with the money, then came back briefly without it. He'd been a millionaire, and now he imagined how he looked from the roof of the courtyard, sick, alone, broke, under indictment, afraid of the return home, and terrified of the temptations there. His quest to find Rachel had kept him focused. There was excitement in the hunt. Now that it was over and he was flat on his back again, he thought of Sergio and rehab and addictions and all the trouble waiting for him. Darkness was looming again. He couldn't spend the rest of his life riding Chalanas up and down the Paraguay with Javi and Welly, far removed from booze and drugs and women, oblivious to his legal troubles. He had to go back. He had to face the music one more time. A piercing squawk jolted him from his daydreams. The red-headed screamer was back. Javi rolled the bed under a veranda, then down a hallway headed toward the front of the hospital. He stopped by a janitor's closet and helped the patient out of bed. Nate was weak and shaky, but determined to escape. Inside the closet, he ripped off the gown and put on a pair of baggy soccer shorts, a red T-shirt, the obligatory rubber sandals, a denim cap, and a pair of plastic sunshades. Though he looked the part, he did not feel the least bit Brazilian. Javi had spent little on his outfit. He was adjusting the cap when he fainted. Javi heard him hit the door. He quickly opened it and found Nate slumped in a pile with buckets and mops rattling around. He clutched him under the arms and dragged him back to the bed. He rolled him into it and covered him with the sheet. Nate opened his eyes and said, "What happened?" "You fainted," came the reply. The bed was moving. Javi was behind him. They passed two nurses who didn't seem to notice them. "This is a bad idea," Javi said. "Just keep going." They parked near the lobby. Nate crawled out of bed, felt faint again, and began walking. Javi placed a heavy arm around his shoulder and steadied him by clutching his bicep. "Take it easy," Javi kept saying. "Nice and slow." No stares from the admissions clerks nor the sick people trying to get in. No odd looks from the nurses and orderlies smoking on the front steps. The sun hit Nate hard, and he leaned on Javi. They crossed the street to where Chevy's massive Ford was parked. They narrowly avoided death at the first intersection. "Could you please drive slower?" Nate snapped. He was sweating and his stomach was rolling. "Sorry," Chevy said, and the truck slowed considerably. With charm and the promise of future payment, Chevy cajoled a double room out of the young girl at the front desk of the Palace Hotel. "My friend is sick," he whispered to her, nodding at Nate, who certainly appeared ill. Javi didn't want the pretty lady to get the wrong idea. They had no bags. In the room, Nate collapsed on the bed. The little escape had tired him immensely. Chevy found the rerun of a soccer game on TV, but after 5 minutes was bored. He left to continue his flirting. Nate tried twice to get an international operator. He had a vague recollection of hearing Josh's voice on the phone, and he suspected that a follow-up was needed. On the second attempt, he got an earful of Portuguese. When she tried English, he thought he caught the words calling card. He hung up and went to sleep. The doctor called Valdir. Valdir found Chevy's truck parked on the street outside the Palace Hotel, and he found Chevy in the pool, sipping a beer. Valdir squatted at the edge of the pool. "Where is Mr. O'Reilly?" he asked. His irritation was obvious. "Upstairs in his room," Chevy answered, then took another sip. "Why is he here?" "Because he wanted to leave the hospital. Do you blame him?" Valdir's only surgery had been in Campo Grande, 4 hours away. No one with money would ever voluntarily submit themselves to the hospital in Corumbá. "How is he?"
"I think he's fine."
"Stay with him."
"I don't work for you anymore, Mr. Valdir."
"Yes, but there is the matter of the boat."
"I can't raise it. I didn't sink it. A storm did. What do you want me to do?"
"I want you to watch Mr. O'Reilly."
"He needs money. Can you wire it in for him?"
"I suppose."
"And he needs a passport. He lost everything."
"Just watch him. I'll take care of the details."
The fever returned quietly during the night, warming his face as he slept, taking its time as it built momentum for the havoc to come. Its calling card was a row of tiny pellets of sweat lined perfectly above the eyebrows, then sweat in the hair that rested on the pillow. It simmered while he slept, stewing, preparing to erupt. It sent tremors, little waves of chills through his body, but he was fatigued and there were the remnants of so many chemicals that he kept sleeping. It built pressure behind his eyes so that when he did open them he would want to scream. It drained the fluids from his mouth. Nate finally groaned. He felt the vicious pounding of a jackhammer between his temples. When he opened his eyes, death awaited him. He was in a pool of sweat, his face on fire, his knees and elbows bending in pain.
"Chevy," he whispered. "Chevy!"
Chevy hit the switch for the table lamp between them, and Nate groaned even louder.
"Turn that off," he said.
Chevy ran to the bathroom and found a less direct source of light. For the ordeal, he had purchased bottled water, ice, aspirin, over-the-counter pain medications, and a thermometer. He thought he was prepared. An hour passed, and Chevy counted every minute of it. The fever climbed to 102. The chills came in waves so violent that the small bed rattled and shook on the floor. When Nate wasn't shaking, Chevy stuffed pills in his mouth and poured down water. He soaked his face with wet towels. Nate suffered in silence, bravely gritting his teeth so that the pain was quiet. He was determined to suffer through the fevers in the relative luxury of the small hotel room. Every time he wanted to scream, he remembered the cracked plaster and smells of the hospital. At 4 a.m., the fever climbed to 103, and Nate began to drift away. His knees almost touched his chin. His arms were wrapped around his calves. He held himself tightly. Then a chill would hit and untangle him as his body shuddered. The last temperature reading was 105, and Chevy knew at some point his friend would go into shock. He finally panicked, not from the temperature, but from the sight of sweat dripping from the bed sheets onto the floor. His friend had suffered enough. There were better drugs at the hospital. He found a janitor asleep on the third floor, and together they dragged Nate to the elevator, through the empty lobby, and to his truck. He called Valdir at 6 a.m., waking him. When Valdir finished cursing Chevy, he agreed to call the doctor. Chapter 37. The treatment was phoned in from the doctor's bed. Fill the IV bag with lots of goodies, poke the needle in his arm, try to find a better room.
The rooms were full, so they simply left him in the hall of the men's ward, near a messy desk they called the nurse's station. At least they couldn't ignore him. Chevy was asked to leave. There was nothing he could do but wait. At one point in the morning, during a lull in other activities, an orderly appeared with a pair of scissors. He cut off the new gym shorts and the new red T-shirt and replaced them with another yellow gown. In the process, Nate lay naked on the bed for 5 full minutes, in plain view of everyone passing by. No one noticed. Nate certainly didn't care. The sheets were changed because they were soaked. The rags that had been the shorts and shirt were thrown away, and once again Nate O'Reilly had no clothes. If he shook too much or moaned too loud, the nearest doctor or nurse or orderly would gently open the IV. And when he was snoring too loud, someone would close it a little. A cancer death created an opening. Nate was rolled into the nearest room, where he was parked between a worker who just lost a foot and a man dying from kidney failure. The doctor saw him twice during the day. The fever wavered between 102 and 104. Valdir stopped by late in the afternoon for a chat, but Nate was not awake. He reported the day's events to Mr. Stafford, who was not pleased.
"The doctor says this is normal," Valdir said, speaking into his cell phone in the hallway. "Mr. O'Reilly will be fine."
"Don't let him die, Valdir," Josh growled from America. Money was being wired. They were working on the passport.
Once again, the IV bag dripped itself empty, and no one noticed. Hours passed, and the drugs gradually wore off. It was pitch dark, the middle of the night, and there was no movement from the other three beds when Nate finally shook off the cobwebs of his coma and showed signs of life. He could barely see his roommates. The door was open, and there was a faint light down the hallway. No voices, no feet shuffling by. He touched his gown and realized he was again naked underneath. The gown was drenched from the sweat. He rubbed his swollen eyes and tried to straighten his cramped legs. His forehead was very hot. He was thirsty and could not remember his last meal. He tried not to move for fear of waking those around him. Surely a nurse would stop by soon. The sheets were wet, so when the chills began again, there was no way to get warm. He shook and vibrated, rubbing his arms and legs, his teeth clapping together. After the chills stopped, he tried to sleep and managed a few naps as the night wore on, but when it was darkest, the fever rose again. His temples pounded so hard that Nate began to cry. He wrapped the pillow around his head and squeezed as hard as he could. In the darkness of the room, a silhouette entered and moved from bed to bed, finally stopping beside Nate's. She watched him flounder and fight under the sheets, his low moans muffled by the pillow. She touched him gently on the arm. "Nate," she whispered. Under normal circumstances, he would have been startled, but hallucinating had become a common symptom. He lowered the pillow to his chest and tried to focus on the figure.
"It's Rachel," she whispered.
"Rachel?" he whispered, his breathing labored.
He tried to sit up, then tried to open his eyes with his fingers.
"Rachel? I'm here, Nate. God sent me to protect you."
He reached for her face, and she took his hand. She kissed his palm.
"You are not going to die, Nate," she said. "God has plans for you."
He could say nothing. Slowly his eyes adjusted, and he could see her.
"It's you," he said.
Or was it another dream? He reclined again, resting his head on the pillow, relaxing as his muscles unclenched themselves and his joints became loose. He closed his eyes, but still held her hand. The pounding behind his eyes faded. The heat left his forehead and face. The fever had sapped his strength, and he drifted away again into a deep sleep induced not by chemicals, but by sheer exhaustion. He dreamed of angels, white-robed young maidens floating in the clouds above him, there to protect him, humming hymns he'd never heard, but that somehow seemed familiar. He left the hospital at noon the next day, armed with his doctor's orders and accompanied by Jevi and Valdir. There was no trace of fever, no rash, just a little soreness in the joints and muscles. He insisted on leaving, and the doctor readily concurred. The doctor was happy to be rid of him. The first stop was a restaurant where he consumed a large bowl of rice and a plate of boiled potatoes. He avoided the steaks and chops. Jevi did not. They were both still hungry from their adventure. Valdir sipped coffee, smoked his cigarettes, and watched them eat. No one had seen Rachel come and go at the hospital. Nate had whispered the secret to Jevi, who had inquired of the nurses and maids. After lunch, Jevi left them and began roaming downtown on foot, searching for her. He went to the river, where he talked to deckhands on the last cattle boat. She had not traveled with them. The fishermen hadn't seen her. No one seemed to know anything about the arrival of a white woman from the Pantanal. In Valdir's office, alone, Nate dialed the number of the Stafford law firm, a number he had trouble remembering. They pulled Josh out of a meeting. "Talk to me, Nate," he said. "How are you?" "The fever is gone," he said, rocking in Valdir's easy chair. "I feel fine. A little sore and tired, but I feel good."
"You sound great. I want you home."
"Give me a couple of days."
"I'm sending a jet down, Nate. It'll leave tonight."
"No, don't do that, Josh. That's not a good idea. I'll get there whenever I want."
"Okay. Tell me about the woman, Nate."
"We found her. She is the illegitimate daughter of Troy Phelan, and she has no interest in the money."
"So how did you talk her into taking it?"
"Josh, you don't talk this woman into anything. I tried, got nowhere, so I stopped."
"Come on, Nate. Nobody walks away from this kind of money. Surely you talk some sense into her."
"Not even close, Josh. She is the happiest person I've ever met, perfectly content to spend the rest of her life working among her people. It's where God wants her to be."
"She signed the papers, though."
"Nope." There was a long pause as Josh absorbed it.
"You must be kidding," he finally said, barely audible in Brazil.
"Nope." "Sorry, boss. I tried my best to convince her to at least sign the papers, but she wouldn't budge. She'll never sign them."
"Did she read the will?"
"Yes."
"And you told her it was $11 billion?
"Yep. She lives alone in a hut with a thatched roof, no plumbing, no electricity, simple food and clothes, no phones or faxes, and no concern about the things she's missing. She's in the Stone Age, Josh, right where she wants to be, and money would change that."
"It's incomprehensible."
"I thought so too, and I was there."
"Is she bright?"
"She's a doctor, Josh, an M.D., and she has a degree from a seminary. She speaks 5 languages.
"A doctor?"
"Yeah, but we didn't talk about medical practice litigation."
"You said she was lovely."
"I did?"
"Yeah, on the phone 2 days ago. I think you were stoned."
"I was, and she is."
"So you liked her?"
"We became friends." It would serve no purpose to tell Josh that she was in Corumbá. Nate hoped to find her quickly and, while in civilization, try to discuss Troy's estate. "It was quite an adventure," Nate said, "to say the least."
"I've lost sleep worrying about you."
"Relax. I'm still in one piece."
"I wired $5,000. Valdir has it."
"Thanks, boss."
"Call me tomorrow."
Valdir invited him to dinner, but he declined. He collected the money and left on foot, loose again on the streets of Corumbá. His first stop was a clothing store where he bought underwear, safari shorts, plain white T-shirts, and hiking boots. By the time he hauled his new wardrobe 4 blocks to the Palace Hotel, Nate was exhausted. He slept for 2 hours. Chevy found no trace of Rachel. He watched the crowds on the busy streets. He talked to the river people he knew so well and heard nothing about her arrival. He walked through the lobbies of the downtown hotels and flirted with the receptionists. No one had seen an American woman of 42 traveling alone. As the afternoon wore on, Chevy doubted his friend's story. Dengue makes you see things, makes you hear voices, makes you believe in ghosts, especially in the night. But he kept searching. Nate roamed too, after his nap and another meal. He walked slowly, pacing himself, trying to keep in the shade and always with a bottle of water in hand. He rested on the bluff above the river, the majesty of the Pantanal spread before him for hundreds of miles. Fatigue hit him hard, and he limped back to the hotel for another rest. He slept again, and when he awoke, Chevy was tapping on the door. They had promised to meet for dinner at 7. It was after 8, and when Chevy entered the room, he immediately began looking for empty bottles. There were none. They ate roasted chicken at a sidewalk cafe. The night was alive with music and foot traffic. Couples with small children bought ice cream and drifted back home. Teenagers moved in packs with no apparent destination. The bars spilled outdoors to the edges of the streets. Young men and women moved from one bar to the next. The streets were warm and safe. No one seemed concerned about getting shot or mugged. At a nearby table, a man drank a cold Brahma beer from a brown bottle, and Nate watched every sip. After dessert, they said goodbye and promised to meet early for another day of searching. Chevy went one direction, Nate another. He was rested and tired of beds. 2 blocks away from the river, and the streets were quieter. The shops were closed, the homes were dark, traffic was lighter. Ahead, he saw the lights of a small chapel. "That," he said almost aloud, "is where she'll be." The front door was wide open, so from the sidewalk Nate could see rows of wooden pews, the empty pulpit, the mural of Christ on the cross, and the backs of a handful of worshippers leaning forward in prayer and meditation. The organ music was low and soft, and it pulled him in. He stopped in the door and counted 5 people scattered among the pews, no 2 sitting together, no one with even the slightest resemblance to Rachel. Under the mural, the organ bench was empty. The music came from a speaker. He could wait. He had the time. She might appear. He shuffled along the back row and sat alone. He studied the crucifixion, the nails through his hands, the sword in his side, the agony in his face. Did they really kill him in such a dreadful manner? Along the way, at some point in his miserable secular life, Nate had read or heard the basic stories of Christ. The virgin birth, thus Christmas, the walking on the water, maybe another miracle or two. Was he swallowed by the whale, or was that someone else? And then the betrayal by Judas, the trial before Pilate, the crucifixion, thus Easter, and finally, the ascension into heaven. Yes, Nate knew the basics. Perhaps his mother had told him. Neither of his wives had been churchgoers, though number 2 was Catholic and they did midnight mass at Christmas every other year. 3 more stragglers came from the street. A young man with a guitar appeared from a side door and went to the pulpit. It was exactly 9:30. He strummed a few chords and began singing, his face glowing with words of faith and praise. A tiny little woman, 1 pew up, clapped her hands and sang along. Maybe the music would draw Rachel. She had to crave real worship in a church with wooden floors and stained glass, with fully clothed people reading Bibles in a modern language. Surely she visited the churches when she was in Corumbá. When the song was finished, the young man read some scripture and began teaching. His Portuguese was the slowest Nate had encountered so far in his little adventure. Nate was mesmerized by the soft, slurring sounds and the unhurried cadence. Though he understood not a word, he tried to repeat the sentences. Then his thoughts drifted. His body had purged the fevers and chemicals. He was well-fed, alert, rested. He was his old self again. And that suddenly depressed him. The present was back, hand in hand with the future. The burdens he'd left with Rachel had found him again, found him then and there, in the chapel. He needed her to sit with him, to hold his hand and help him pray. He hated his weaknesses. He named them, one by one, and was saddened by the list. The demons were waiting at home, the good friends and the bad friends, the haunts and habits, the pressures he couldn't stand anymore. Life could not be lived with the likes of Sergio at $1,000 a day, and life could not be lived free on the streets. The young man was praying, his eyes clenched tightly, his arms waving gently upward. Nate closed his eyes too, and called God's name. God was waiting. With both hands, he clenched the back of the pew in front of him. He repeated the list, mumbling softly every weakness and flaw and affliction and evil that plagued him. He confessed them all. In one long, glorious acknowledgement of failure, he laid himself bare before God. He held nothing back. He unloaded enough burdens to crush any three men, and when he finally finished, Nate had tears in his eyes. "I'm sorry," he whispered to God. "Please help me." As quickly as the fever had left his body, he felt the baggage leave his soul. With one gentle brush of the hand, his slate had been wiped clean. He breathed a massive sigh of relief. But his pulse was racing. He heard the guitar again. He opened his eyes and wiped his cheeks. Instead of seeing the young man in the pulpit, Nate saw the face of Christ in agony and pain, dying on the cross, dying for him. A voice was calling Nate, a voice from within, a voice leading him down the aisle. But the invitation was confusing. He felt many conflicting emotions. His eyes were suddenly dry. "Why am I crying in a small, hot chapel, listening to music I don't understand, in a town I'll never see again?" The questions poured forth, the answers elusive. It was one thing for God to forgive his astounding array of iniquities, and Nate certainly felt as though his burdens were lighter. But it was a far more difficult step to expect himself to become a follower. As he listened to the music, he became bewildered. God couldn't be calling him. He was Nate O'Reilly, boozer, addict, lover of women, absent father, miserable husband, greedy lawyer, swindler of tax money. The sad list went on and on. He was dizzy. The music stopped, and the young man prepared for another song. Nate hurriedly left the chapel. As he turned a corner, he glanced back, hoping to see Rachel, but also to make sure God hadn't sent someone to follow him. He needed someone to talk to. He knew she was in Corumbá, and he vowed to find her. Chapter 38. The despachante is an integral part of Brazilian life. No business, bank, law firm, medical group, or person with money can operate without the services of a despachante. He is a facilitator extraordinaire. In a country where the bureaucracy is sprawling and antiquated, the despachante is the guy who knows the city clerks, the courthouse crowd, the bureaucrats, the customs agents. He knows the system and how to grease it. No official paper or document is obtained in Brazil without waiting in long lines, and the despachante is the guy who'll stand there for you. For a small fee, he'll wait 8 hours to renew your auto inspection, then affix it to your windshield while you're busy at the office. He'll do your voting, banking, packaging, mailing. The list has no end. No bureaucratic obstacle is too intimidating. Firms of despachantes display their names in windows just like lawyers and doctors. They're in the yellow pages. The job requires no formal training. All one needs is a quick tongue, patience, and a lot of brass. Valdir's despachante in Corumbá knew another one in Sao Paulo, a powerful one with high contacts, and for a fee of $2,000, a new passport would be delivered. Jevi spent the next few mornings at the river, helping a friend repair a shawana. He watched everything and heard the gossip, not a word about the woman. By noon on Friday, he was convinced she had not arrived in Corumbá, at least not in the past 2 weeks. Jevi knew all the fishermen, captains, and deckhands, and they loved to talk. If an American woman who lived with the Indians suddenly arrived in town, they would know it. Nate searched until the end of the week. He walked the streets, watched the crowds, checked out hotel lobbies and sidewalk cafes, looked at the faces, and saw no one even remotely resembling Rachel. At 1, on his last day, he stopped at Valdir's office and collected his passport. They said goodbye like old friends and promised to see each other soon. Both knew it would never happen. At 2, Jevi drove him to the airport. They sat in the departure lounge for half an hour, watching as the only plane was unloaded, then prepped for reboarding. Jevi wanted to spend time in the U.S. and needed Nate's help. "I'll need a job," he said. Nate listened with sympathy, not certain if he himself was still employed. "I'll see what I can do." They talked about Colorado and the West and places Nate had never been. Jevi was in love with the mountains. And after 2 weeks in the Pantanal, Nate understood this. When it was time to go, they embraced warmly and said farewell. Nate walked across the hot pavement to the plane, carrying his entire wardrobe in a small gym bag. The turboprop with 20 seats landed twice before it reached Campo Grande. There, the passengers boarded a jet for Sao Paulo. The lady in the seat next to him ordered a beer from the drink cart. Nate studied the can, less than 10 inches away. "Not anymore," he told himself. He closed his eyes and asked God to give him strength. He ordered coffee. The flight to Dulles left at midnight. It would arrive in D.C. at 9 the next morning. His search for Rachel had taken him out of the country for almost 3 weeks. He wasn't sure where his car was. He had no place to live and no means to get one. But he couldn't worry. Josh would take care of the details. The plane dropped through the clouds at 9,000 feet. Nate was awake, sipping coffee, dreading the streets of home. The streets were cold and white. The earth was blanketed by a heavy snow. It was lovely for a few minutes as they approached Dulles. Then Nate remembered how much he hated the winter. He wore a thin pair of trousers, no socks, cheap sneakers, and a fake polo shirt he'd paid $6 for in the Sao Paulo airport. He had no coat. He would sleep somewhere that night, probably in a hotel, unsupervised in D.C. for the first time since August 4th, the night he'd staggered into a suburban motel room. It had happened at the bottom of a long, pathetic crash. He'd worked hard to forget it. But that was the old Nate, and now there was a new one. He was 48 years old, 13 months away from 50, and ready for a different life. God had fortified him and strengthened his resolve. He had 30 years left. They wouldn't be spent clutching empty bottles, nor would they be spent on the run. Snowplows raced about as they taxied to the terminal. The runways were wet, and flurries were still falling. When Nate stepped off the plane into the tunnel, winter hit him, and he thought of the humid streets of Corumbá. Josh was waiting at the baggage claim, and of course he had an extra overcoat.
"You look awful," were his first words.
"Thanks." Nate grabbed the coat and put it on.
"You're skinny as a rail."
"You want to lose 15 pounds? Find the right mosquito." They moved with a mob toward the exits, bodies jostling and bumping, a shove here, a push there, the throng squeezing tighter to fit through doors.
"Welcome home," he said to himself.
"You're traveling light," Josh said, pointing at his gym bag.
"My worldly possessions." With no socks or gloves, Nate was freezing on the curb by the time Josh found him with the car. The snowstorm had hit during the night and had attained the status of a blizzard. Against the buildings, the drifts had reached 2 feet.
"It was 93 yesterday in Corumbá," Nate said as they left the airport.
"Don't tell me you miss it."
"I do. Suddenly I do."
"Look, Gail is in London. I thought you could stay at our place for a couple of days."
Josh's house could sleep 15.
"Sure, thanks. Where's my car?"
"In my garage."
Of course it was. It was a leased Jaguar, and it no doubt had been properly serviced, washed, and waxed, and the monthly payments were current.
"Thanks, Josh."
"I put your furnishings in a mini-storage. Your clothes and personal effects are packed in the car."
"Thanks."
Nate was not at all surprised.
"How do you feel?"
"I'm fine."
"Look, Nate, I've read about dengue fever. It takes a month to fully recover. Level with me."
A month. It was the opening jab in the fight over Nate's future with the firm. "Take another month, old boy. Maybe you're too ill to work." Nate could write the script. But there would be no fight.
"I'm a little weak, that's all. I'm sleeping a lot, drinking a lot of liquids."
"What kind of liquids?"
"Get right to the point, don't you?"
"I always do."
"I'm clean, Josh. Relax. No stumbles."
Josh had heard that many times. The exchange had been a bit sharper than both men wanted, so they rode in silence for a while. The traffic was slow. The Potomac was half frozen, with large chunks of ice floating slowly toward Georgetown. Stalled in traffic on the chain bridge, Nate announced, matter-of-factly, "I'm not going back to the office, Josh. Those days are over." There was no visible reaction from Josh. He could have been disappointed because an old friend and fine litigator was calling it quits. He could have been delighted because a major headache was quietly leaving the firm. He could have been indifferent because Nate's exit was probably inevitable. The tax evasion mess would ultimately cost him his license anyway. So he simply asked, "Why?"
"Lots of reasons, Josh. Let's just say I'm tired."
"Most litigators burn out after 20 years.
"So I've heard."
Enough of the retirement talk. Nate's mind was made up, and Josh didn't want to change it. The Super Bowl was 2 weeks away, and the Redskins were not in it. They seized the topic of football, as men usually do when they have to keep the conversation going in the midst of weightier matters. Even under a heavy layer of snow, the streets looked mean to Nate. The Staffords owned a large manor house in Wesley Heights, in northwest D.C. They also had a cottage on the Chesapeake and a cabin in Maine. The four kids were grown and scattered. Mrs. Stafford preferred to travel, while her husband preferred to work. Nate retrieved some warm clothes from the trunk of his car, then enjoyed a hot shower in the guest quarters. The water pressure was weaker in Brazil. The shower in his hotel room was never hot and never cold. The bars of soap were smaller. He compared the things around him. He was amused at the thought of the shower on the Santa Laura, a cord above the toilet that, when pulled, delivered lukewarm river water from a showerhead. He was tougher than he thought. The adventure had taught him that much. He shaved and then worked on his teeth, going about his habits with great deliberation. In many ways, it was nice to be home. Josh's office in his basement was larger than the one downtown, and just as cluttered. They met there for coffee. It was time to debrief. Nate began with the ill-fated effort to find Rachel by air, the crash landing, the dead cow, the three little boys, the bleakness of Christmas and the Pantanal. With great detail, he recounted the story of his ride on the horse and the encounter in the swamp with the curious alligator. Then the rescue by helicopter. He said nothing about the binge on Christmas night. It would serve no purpose, and he was terribly ashamed of it. He described Chevy, Welly, the Santa Laura, and the trip north. When he and Chevy were lost in the John boat, he remembered being frightened, but too busy to be consumed with fear. Now, in the safety of civilization, their wandering seemed terrifying. Josh was astounded by the adventure. He wanted to apologize for sending Nate into such a treacherous place, but the excursion had obviously been exciting. The alligators grew as the narrative continued. The lone anaconda sunning by the river was joined by another that swam near their boat. Nate described the Indians, their nakedness and bland food and languid lives, the chief and his refusal to let them leave. And Rachel. At that point in the debriefing, Josh took his legal pad and began writing notes. Nate portrayed her in great detail, from her soft, slow voice to her sandals and hiking boots, her hut and medicine bag, Laco and his limp, and the way the Indians looked at her when she walked by. He told the story of the child who died from the snake bite. He relayed what little of her history she'd given him. With the precision of a courtroom veteran, Nate covered everything about Rachel that he'd gathered on his visit. He used her exact words when talking about the money and the paperwork. He remembered her comment about how primitive Troy's handwritten will looked. Nate recounted what little he remembered of their retreat from the Pantanal, and he downplayed the horror of dengue fever. He had survived, and that in itself surprised him. A maid brought soup and hot tea for lunch. "Here's where we are," Josh said after a few spoonfuls. "If she rejects the gift under Troy's will, then the money remains in his estate. If, however, the will is found to be invalid for any reason, then there is no will." "How can the will be invalid? They had psychiatrists talking to him minutes before he jumped." "Now there are more psychiatrists, well paid and with different opinions. It'll get messy. All of his prior wills were shredded. If it's one day found that he died with no valid will, then his children, all seven of them, will share equally in his estate. Since Rachel doesn't want a share, then hers will be divided by the other six."
"Those fools will get $1 billion each."
"Something like that."
"What are the chances of striking down his will?"
"Not good. I'd rather have our case than theirs, but things can change."
Nate walked around the room, nibbling on a saltine, weighing the issues.
"Why fight for the validity of the will if Rachel declines everything?"
"Three reasons," Josh said quickly. As usual, he had analyzed everything from all possible angles. There was a master plan, and it would be revealed to Nate piece by piece. "First, and most important, my client prepared a valid will. It gave away his assets exactly as he wanted. I, as his lawyer, have no choice but to fight to protect the integrity of the will. Second, I know how Mr. Phelan felt about his children. He was horrified that they would somehow get their hands on his money. I share his feelings about them, and I shudder to think what would happen if they got $1 billion each. Third, there's always a chance Rachel will change her mind."
"Don't count on it."
"Look, Nate, she's only human. She has those papers with her. She'll wait a few days and start to think about them. Maybe thoughts of wealth have never entered her mind, but at some point she has to think of all the good things she could do with the money. Did you explain trusts and charitable foundations to her?"
"I barely know what those are myself, Josh. I was a litigator, remember?"
"We're going to fight to protect Mr. Phelan's will, Nate. Problem is, the biggest seat at the table is empty. Rachel needs representation."
"No, she doesn't. She's oblivious."
The litigation can't proceed until she has a lawyer.
Nate was no match for the master strategist. The black hole opened from nowhere, and he was already falling into it. He closed his eyes and said,
"You must be kidding."
"No, and we can't delay much longer. Troy died a month ago. Judge Wycliffe is desperate to know the whereabouts of Rachel Lane. 6 lawsuits have been filed contesting the will, and there's a lot of pressure behind them. Everything gets reported in the papers. If we give any hint that Rachel plans to decline the bequest, then we lose control. The Phelan heirs and their lawyers go crazy. The judge suddenly loses interest in upholding Troy's last testament."
"So I'm her lawyer."
"There's no way around it, Nate. If you're quitting, that's fine, but you have to take one last case. Just sit at the table and protect her interests. We'll do the heavy lifting."
"But there's a conflict. I'm a partner in your firm."
"It's a minor conflict, because our interests are the same. We, the estate, and Rachel have the same goal of protecting the will. We sit at the same table. And technically, we can claim you left the firm last August."
"There's a lot of truth in that."
Both acknowledged the sad truth. Josh sipped his tea, his eyes never leaving Nate.
"At some point, we go to Wycliffe and tell him that you found Rachel, that she plans to make no appearance at this time, that she is not sure what to do, but that she wants you to protect her interests."
"Then we'll be lying to the judge."
"It's a small lie, Nate, and he'll thank us for it later. He's anxious to start proceedings, but he can't until he hears from Rachel. If you're her lawyer, the war begins. I'll do the lying."
"So I'm a one-man office working on my last case."
"Right."
"I'm leaving town, Josh. I'm not staying."
Nate said this, then he laughed.
"Where would I stay?"
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know. I haven't thought that far ahead."
"I have an idea."
"I'm sure you do."
"Take my cottage on Chesapeake Bay. We don't use it in the wintertime. It's at St. Michael's, 2 hours away. You can drive in when you need it and stay here. Again, Nate, we'll do the work."
Nate studied the bookshelves for a while. 24 hours earlier, he'd been eating a sandwich on a park bench in Corumbá, watching the pedestrians and waiting for Rachel to appear. He had vowed to never again voluntarily step into a courtroom. But he grudgingly admitted that the plan had its strong points. He certainly couldn't imagine a better client. The case would never go to trial. And with the money at stake, he could at least earn a living for a few months. Josh finished his soup and moved to the next item on the list.
"I propose a fee of $10,000 a month."
"That's generous, Josh."
"I think we can squeeze it from the old man's estate. With no overhead, it'll get you back on your feet."
"Until..."
"Right, until we settle with the IRS.
"Any word from the judge?"
"I call him occasionally. We had lunch last week."
"So he's your buddy?"
"We've known each other for a long time. Forget jail, Nate. The government will settle for a big fine and a 5-year suspension of your law license."
"They can have my law license."
"Not yet. We need it for one more case."
"How long will the government wait?"
"A year. It's not a priority."
"Thanks, Josh."
Nate was tired again. The all-night flight, the ravages of the jungle, the mental jousting with Josh. He wanted a warm, soft bed in a dark room. Chapter 39. At 6 Sunday morning, Nate finished another hot shower, his third in 24 hours, and began making plans for a quick departure. One night in the city, and he was anxious to leave. The cottage on the bay was calling him. D.C. had been his home for 26 years, and since the decision to leave had been made, he was eager to move on. With no address, moving was easy. He found Josh in the basement at his desk on the phone with a client in Thailand. As Nate listened to one half of the conversation about natural gas deposits, he was quite happy to be leaving the practice of law. Josh was 12 years older, a very rich man, and his idea of fun was to be at his desk at 6:30 on a Sunday morning. "Don't let it happen to me," Nate said to himself. But he knew it wouldn't. If he went back to the office, he would return to the grind. 4 rehabs meant a 5th was somewhere down the road. He wasn't as strong as Josh. He'd be dead in 10 years. There was an element of excitement in walking away. Suing doctors was a nasty business, one he could do without. Nor would he miss the stress of a high-powered office. He'd had his career, his triumphs. Success had brought him nothing but misery. He couldn't handle it. Success had thrown him in the gutter. Now that the horror of jail had been removed, he could enjoy a new life. He left with a trunkload of clothes, leaving the rest in a box in Josh's garage. The snow had stopped, but the plows were still catching up. The streets were slick. And after 2 blocks, it occurred to Nate that he had not held the wheel of a car in over 5 months. There was no traffic, though, and he crept along Wisconsin into Chevy Chase, then onto the Beltway where the ice and snow had been cleared. Alone, in his own fine car, he began to feel like an American again. He thought of Chevy and his loud, dangerous Ford truck and wondered how long he would last on the Beltway. And he thought of Welly, a kid so poor his family owned no car. Nate planned to write letters in the days to come, and he would send one to his buddies in Corumbá. The phone caught his attention. He picked it up. It appeared to be working. Of course, Josh had made sure the bills were paid. He called Sergio at home, and they talked for 20 minutes. He got scolded for not calling sooner. Sergio had been worried. He explained the situation with telephone service in the Pantanal. Things were going in a different direction. There were some unknowns, but his adventure was continuing. He was leaving the profession and avoiding jail. Sergio never asked about sobriety. Nate certainly sounded clean and strong. He gave him the number at the cottage, and they promised to have lunch soon. He called his oldest son at Northwestern in Evanston and left a message on the recorder. Where would a 23-year-old grad student be at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning? Not at early mass. Nate didn't want to know. Whatever his son was doing, he would never screw up as badly as his father. His daughter was 21, an on-again, off-again student at Pitt. Their last conversation had been about tuition, a day before Nate checked into the motel room with a bottle of rum and a sack full of pills. He couldn't find her phone number. Their mother had remarried twice since leaving Nate. She was an unpleasant person, whom he called only when absolutely necessary. He would wait a couple of days, then ask her for their daughter's phone number. He was determined to make the painful trip west to Oregon to at least see his 2 youngest children. Their mother had remarried too, remarkably to another lawyer, but one who evidently lived a clean life. He would ask them for forgiveness and try to establish the frail beginnings of a relationship. He wasn't sure how to do this, but he vowed to try. In Annapolis, he stopped at a cafe and had breakfast. He listened to the weather predictions from a group of rowdy regulars in a booth, and he mindlessly scanned the Post. From the headlines and late-breaking stories, Nate saw nothing that interested him in the least. The news never changed. Trouble in the Middle East, trouble in Ireland, scandals in Congress. The markets were up, then down. An oil spill, another AIDS drug, guerrillas killing peasants in Latin America, turmoil in Russia. His clothes hung loose on him, so he ate 3 eggs with bacon and biscuits. A shaky consensus emerged from the booth that more snow was on the way. He crossed the Chesapeake on the Bay Bridge. The highways on the eastern shore had not been plowed well. The Jaguar skidded twice, and he slowed down. The car was a year old, and he couldn't remember when the lease expired. His secretary had handled the paperwork. He'd picked the color. He decided to get rid of it as soon as possible and find an old 4-wheel drive. The fancy lawyer's car had once seemed so important. Now, he had no need for it. At Easton, he turned onto State Route 33, a road with 2 inches of loose snow still resting on the blacktop. Nate followed the tracks of other vehicles and soon passed through sleepy little settlements with harbors filled with sailboats. The shores of the Chesapeake were covered with heavy snow. Its waters were deep blue. St. Michael's had a population of 1,300. Route 33 became Main Street for a few blocks as it ran through the town. There were shops and stores on both sides, old buildings side by side, all well-preserved and ready for the postcard. Nate had heard of St. Michael's all his life. There was a maritime museum, an oyster festival, an active harbor, dozens of quaint little bed and breakfasts which attracted city folks for long weekends. He passed the post office and a small church, where the rector was shoveling snow from the front steps. The cottage was on Green Street, 2 blocks off Main, facing north with a view of the harbor. It was Victorian, with twin gables and a long front porch that wrapped around to the sides. Painted slate blue with white and yellow trim, the house had snowdrifts almost to the front door. The front lawn was small, the driveway under 2 feet of snow. Nate parked at the curb and fought his way to the porch. He flipped on lights inside as he walked to the rear. In a closet by the back door, he found a plastic shovel. He spent a wonderful hour cleaning the porch, clearing the drive and sidewalk, working his way back to his car. Not surprisingly, the house was richly decorated with period pieces, and it was tidy and organized. Josh said a maid came every Wednesday to dust and clean. Mrs. Stafford stayed there for 2 weeks in the spring and one in the fall. Josh had slept there 3 nights in the past 18 months. There were 4 bedrooms and 4 baths, some cottage. But there was no coffee to be found, and this presented the first emergency of the day. Nate locked the doors and headed for town. The sidewalks were clear and wet from melting snow. According to the thermometer in the window of the barber shop, the temperature was 35 degrees. The shops and stores were closed. Nate studied their windows as he ambled along. Ahead, the church bells began. According to the bulletin handed to Nate by the elderly usher, the rector was Father Phil Lancaster, a short, wiry little man with thick, horn-rimmed glasses and curly hair that was red and gray. He could have been 35 or 50. His flock for the 11 o'clock service was old and thin, no doubt hampered by the weather. Nate counted 21 people in the small sanctuary, and that included Phil and the organist. There were many gray heads. It was a handsome church, with a vaulted ceiling, pews and floors of dark wood, 4 windows of stained glass. When the lone usher took his seat in the back pew, Phil rose in his black robe and welcomed them to Trinity Church, where everyone was at home. His voice was high and nasal, and he needed no microphone. In his prayer, he thanked God for snow and winter, for the seasons given as reminders that he was always in control. They struggled through the hymns and prayers. When Father Phil preached, he noticed Nate, the sole visitor, sitting in the next-to-last row. They exchanged smiles, and for one scary moment, Nate was afraid he was about to be introduced to the small crowd. His sermon was on the subject of enthusiasm, an odd choice given the average age of his congregation. Nate struggled hard to pay attention, but began to drift. His thoughts returned to the little chapel in Corumbá, with the front doors open, the windows up, the heat drifting through, the dying Christ suffering on the cross, the young man with the guitar. Careful not to offend Phil, he managed to keep his eyes fixed on the globe of a dim light on the wall behind and above the pulpit. Given the thickness of the preacher's eyeglasses, he figured his disinterest would go unnoticed. Sitting in the warm little church, finally safe from the uncertainties of his great adventure, safe from fevers and storms, safe from the dangers of D.C., safe from his addictions, safe from spiritual extinction, Nate realized that for the first time in memory, he was at peace.
He feared nothing. God was pulling him in some direction. He wasn't certain where, but he wasn't afraid either. Be patient, he told himself. Then he whispered a prayer. He thanked God for sparing his life, and he prayed for Rachel because he knew she was praying for him. The serenity made him smile. When the prayer was over, he opened his eyes and saw that Phil was smiling at him. After the benediction, they filed past Phil at the front door, each complimenting him on the sermon and mentioning some brief bit of church news. The line moved slowly. It was a ritual. "How's your aunt?" Phil asked one of his flock, then listened carefully as the aunt's latest affliction was described. "How's that hip?" he asked another. "How was Germany?" He clutched their hands and bent forward to hear every word. He knew what was on their minds. Nate waited patiently at the end of the line. There was no hurry. He had nothing else to do. "Welcome," Father Phil said as he grabbed Nate by the hand and arm. "Welcome to Trinity." He squeezed so tightly, Nate wondered if he were the first guest in years. "I'm Nate O'Reilly," he said, then added, "from Washington," as if that would help define him. "So nice to have you with us this morning," Phil said, his big eyes dancing behind the glasses. Up close, the wrinkles revealed that he was at least 50. His head had more gray curls than red. "I'm staying in the Stafford Cottage for a few days," Nate said. "Yes, yes, a lovely home. When did you arrive?"
"This morning."
"Are you alone?"
"Yes."
"Well, then you must join us for lunch."
The aggressive hospitality made Nate laugh.
"Well, thanks, but..."
Phil was all smiles, too.
"No, I insist. My wife makes a lamb stew every time it snows. It's on the stove now. We have so few guests in the wintertime. Please, the parsonage is just behind the church."
Nate was in the hands of a man who'd shared his Sunday table with hundreds.
"Really, I was just stopping by.
And it's our pleasure," Phil said, already tugging at Nate's arm and leading him back toward the pulpit. "What do you do in Washington?"
"I'm a lawyer," Nate said. A complete answer would get complicated.
"What brings you here?"
"It's a long story."
"Oh, wonderful. Laura and I love stories. Let's have a long lunch and tell stories. We'll have a grand time."
His enthusiasm was irresistible. Poor guy was starved for fresh conversation. "Why not?" thought Nate. There was no food in the cottage. All stores appeared to be closed.